This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of January 14th, 2019. I'm Mason King. Before we get into our discussion today, here's a quick history lesson, and we'll call it Mind Trust 101. A not-for-profit education reform group, the Mind Trust was created in 2006 by the former director of charter schools for Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson. Now, its mission, in the broadest sense, is to improve the quality of public education for K through 12 and make sure every kid in Indianapolis has access to a great school. For example, it recruits educators and gives them the mentoring and resources needed to launch innovative schools. It brings teacher development and education advocacy groups to the city. And it has supported legislation and proposed sweeping policy changes that it thinks will help improve public education and give individual schools more flexibility and autonomy. For example, it was a prime backer of the move to create so-called innovation schools in the Indianapolis Public Schools District. Innovation schools are considered part of the district, but they are managed independently, so their leaders can make most decisions about academics and operations without interference from the district. Since 2015, IPS has either added or converted 18 schools to its innovation network. On Friday, IBJ reported a major milestone for the Mind Trust. It has raised three grants totaling $24.4 million. This big influx of funds will help it continue its work incubating new schools, but also boost a relatively new focus on supporting schools once they're up and running. We invited the Mind Trust's Brandon Brown, who became CEO last year, to explain what's happening, as well as to answer some of the persistent criticisms of the group. Brandon, thank you for participating in the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get going, I just want to kind of give everybody a heads up. Now, you've had several jobs in education policy before becoming CEO of the Mind Trust last year. But I want to draw on your experience from the classroom. You taught, I believe, high school?
Yes.
For Teach for America. You have a master's degree in secondary education. I want you to assume I am a seventh grader who has no knowledge of education reform. Let's keep our conversation on that level, just simple and direct, because I am, even as an adult, extremely easy to confuse. So for our first question, please explain to me, seventh grade Mason, what does the Mind Trust do?
So we are an organization that has a mission to ensure that every kid in our city, regardless of their race, their income, or their background, has access to a great education. We do that through three major strategies. One is we work to recruit and support transformative school leaders to go open up new schools that are high performing for kids. Second is we support existing schools to move from good to great, to really ensure that they are maximizing their success for students. And then third, probably the most important thing we do, is engage the community around the changes that are happening in the education system.
So when you are helping great education leaders to create schools, are those typically charter schools and innovation network schools?
Yes.
Is that right? And then what are those?
So we believe that there are three components that give a school the maximum chance to be successful. One is a great school leader. Two is the autonomy for that school leader to make decisions as close to kids as possible. And then three is for that school leader to be held accountable for achieving results. So any school that has those three conditions is a school that where we want to invest in. So a charter school, really in essence, is a public school that has freedoms from a lot of the restrictions that most schools have. So they have freedom to hire their own staff. They have the freedom to choose their own curriculum. They have the freedom to have a longer school day, a longer school year. So it really kind of marries this notion around if you empower great leaders to make their own decisions and then hold them accountable for results, you tend to get really good outcomes. Right. And that's really the notion behind what a charter school is. A really important thing for folks to understand is that, at least in Indiana, charter schools are governed by nonprofit organizations. So, you know, a nonprofit then has a contractual agreement with an authorizer, which in our city is usually the mayor's office, and then the mayor's office then sets the expectations for what that school should achieve. So that nonprofit then is responsible for meeting the expectations in their contract with the mayor.
Now, what is an innovation network school?
The same general idea of a charter, so the same level of autonomy, but the difference is that the innovation school lives within a school district. So when the charter school law was passed in 2001, up until when the innovation school law happened in 2014, all of the chartering of schools happened outside of a school district, which really tended to pit charters versus school districts against each other.
Yeah.
The innovation school law came along and allows school districts like IPS to have contractually autonomous schools, but those schools live within the district. The kids count for the enrollment for the district, the results count for the district, and the district then has that performance contract with the nonprofit board to directly hold the school accountable. So it's a similar concept to the charter work, but it kind of marries the autonomy of charter schools with the resources and scale of a school district, so that a lot of the reform work now can happen in a more coordinated way and can happen in collaboration with the district, as opposed to much of the work in the past was really antagonistic.
So the benefit to the district of having an innovation school in the district is what?
They're able to do a whole bunch of things. So one benefit is if you have a low-performing school that's been low-performing for several years, the state has the opportunity to come in and to take that school over. So in 2011, we saw four schools in IPS that were persistently low-performing taken over by the state with very little local community input. Via the innovation school law, the district is able to intervene in that school before the state does. Mm. So it's a locally driven reform that's led by the elected school board rather than waiting for the state to come in and make a decision that may or may not be what our community wants. So this is a great tool then for a district to help turn around their low performing schools along the lines of what they want to do rather than waiting for the state to tell them what to do.
Mm-hmm. And this is good for kids. Why?
Because a lot of the research, at least in our city, shows that students who attend contractually autonomous schools...
And when we say contractually autonomous, what does that mean?
That's a great question. So students that attend either an innovation school or a charter tend to significantly outperform their peers who are in direct-run schools inside of a district. And we have a growing body of research. We have growing sets of accountability data that really speak to this. So... Mm-hmm. We're all about ensuring that more kids have access to great schools, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about what are the conditions that are going to lead to those kind of outcomes, and then how can we grow the number of schools that actually have those conditions. And it just so happens that the innovation schools and charter schools have led to the most promising results, especially for low-income students and especially for students of color.
Quick question. In an innovation school, innovation district school, is the teacher employed by the district or by the school?
The teacher is an employee of the nonprofit organization that manages the school.
Okay.
And then that nonprofit organization has a contract with the district.
So, but when teachers like negotiate contracts for public schools, they would not be included.
Right. So they do live outside the collective bargaining unit of the district, but the law gives those schools the ability to unionize if they so choose.
Okay. How many schools has the Mind Trust had a role in incubating and opening so far?
So throughout the 12 and a half years of our existence, we've incubated 24 schools. 18 of those have been since 2015.
How has the Mind Trust strategy, or how is it today different from the strategy when it opened in 2006?
It's a great question. You know, one of the characteristics of the Mind Trust throughout the life of the organization is because we're a nonprofit, we're able to continually evolve relative to the conditions in our city. So when we were founded in 2006, we were really founded to be a hub to attract outstanding talent and then to support that outstanding talent to achieve their vision for kids in our city. So we really wanted to become almost the Silicon Valley for education. Attract the best talent, resource them, support them to go launch new organizations or new schools in our city. We're still about that, but now 12 and a half years later, we are working within an ecosystem that has a lot of opportunity to hone in on school creation and to make sure that the innovation school law in particular has a clear implementation plan. So it's not just enough to have a great law. but you really need a localized implementation plan. So the Mind Trust really has evolved into a partner with IPS and the mayor's office to really implement the laws and the books. And the way that we view our major role in that is to recruit and support outstanding school leaders to go launch schools. So the same, you know, mission, the same general philosophy, but we're much more focused right now on launching and supporting schools.
Okay. The Mind Trust has been involved in supporting and I guess also promulgating legislation to change the way that we educate kids.
So as a nonprofit organization, we don't directly do anything related to legislation. What we did do, though, is in 2011, we put out what we called the Opportunity Schools Report that called for two things. One was pretty controversial, and one really got traction. The controversial one is we called for the mayor to be in charge of the school system. Didn't go very well, and we kind of learned some lessons from that. The other piece, though, is that we called for high-performing school leaders to have more autonomy, to make their own decisions as close to kids as possible. That really caught on, and it kind of helped change the conversation in our city leading into the 2012 school board election. So when a candidate ran for school board in 2012, they were asked, what do you think about the Mind Trust plan? Well, it was easy for them to say the mayor shouldn't be in charge because they were running to be an elected official that was a school board member. But many of them really attached this idea of empowering great educators with more autonomy. Nobody wants a bloated central office. We all, I think, can collectively believe that we ought to get as much resources and as much autonomy to schools as possible. So that really caught on. And the conversation shifted in particular when the new superintendent came on and there was a mayor's office that was really excited to work with IPS. The Mind Trust had this report and the stars kind of aligned where in 2014, the mayor's office and the district were able to come together to advocate for the innovation school law, which is really the opportunity schools concept that was in the 2011 report with the Mind Trust. So while we didn't have anything directly to do with the legislation, I think we did have something to do with changing the narrative and changing the conversation publicly.
So let's jump to these three grants and the reason why we're here today. Mind Trust recently received three grants worth a total of $24.4 million for its work. Let's just take these individually, starting with the biggest. Tell me how much it is and how much or what it will do.
Yeah, so we are just incredibly humbled and blessed to receive the largest grant in the history of the organization. So that's an $18 million grant from a national nonprofit called the City Fund. And this is a group that was recently formed with education leaders across the country to invest in cities like Indianapolis, where the local community has a clear plan for change.
So what does it do, though, the $18 million?
Yeah, so it will fuel much of the work that we're currently doing. So it will help us award more school fellowships to great leaders to go launch new schools. It will help us to expand and accelerate our school supports work. It will help us to engage the community. So really, the resources from this grant will be used across the three major priorities that we have in our high quality schools plan to really enable us to do the work that we're doing right now and to really accelerate the change.
Okay. Second, $3.42 million from the Lilly Endowment. What does that do?
Yes. Well, the Lilly Endowment has been an extraordinary partner from day one. So they have invested over $20 million in the Mind Trust over the 12 and a half years of our organization's existence. This grant in particular funds Teach for America and TNTP to ensure that they're able to continue to attract new teachers into our system.
Let me stop you, TNTP.
Formerly called the New Teacher Project. Actually, now it's just called TNTP, which is a national nonprofit that does a couple things. One is they place new teachers into schools, and then they also do a lot of work around education policy, working with school districts across the country to really transform what they do. So they run a program here that places new teachers into schools within IPS.
$3 million from the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation.
So like the Lilly Endowment, we have been blessed to have support from the Fairbanks Foundation since day one. And this grant in particular is really important to us because it funds a really good chunk of our operations. You know, so in the nonprofit world, it's much easier to raise funds for really exciting programs. It's really hard to raise money to keep the lights on.
Hmm. My impression is this is an extraordinary amount of money to come in basically all at once, right?
Yeah, so we've raised about $108 million in the close to 13-year history of the Mind Trust. And if you think about this $24 million all coming in at once, it's probably safe to say this is the largest collective investment in the education transformation work that's happening in our city that we've ever seen.
In addition to just simply having more money, does this herald a strategy shift in a way, or a change in the way that the Mind Trust is approaching its job?
So we're about 3 years into a 7-year high quality schools plan. Where
is that something that you call the high quality schools?
Yeah, plan? Yeah. And really, the high quality schools plan is the three things that I talked about earlier:
yeah.
Growing great schools, supporting great schools, and engaging the community. So where we are, we're in the middle of that plan. So these investments represent a continuation of that plan, and in some ways, an acceleration. But we really don't expect a lot of strategic shifts. Because we think the work that's happening is showing promising progress. We have a lot more results now than we did a few years ago. And this work is to really start to scale what we're seeing on the ground. And, you know, hopefully...
What do you mean, scale?
Yeah, no, that's a great question.
Yeah.
So what we've proven in Indianapolis is that schools with the right conditions and the right leadership can achieve at high levels regardless. And we've proven that now at the school level. I think the next step is to prove that at a system level.
How does this money help you do that?
This will help us launch, hopefully, a large number of new schools. It will help us deepen our supports with existing schools to ensure that they're objectively achieving really great results for kids. And I think what I'm most excited about is this will enable us to do even more engagement in the community. One thing that we feel really strongly about is our community needs a strategy to not just engage families, but to empower families that they're able to organize for change.
I wanted to touch on the middle point that you made about supporting schools that have already been started.
We've historically been really focused on the incubation of new ideas. We're still going to be doing that, but we've learned a lot. And we think that ongoing support after that organization is launched is critically important to ensure that it's maximizing its success, especially in the school setting. We have new state standards, we have a new assessment that are much more rigorous than what we're used to, and schools have struggled oftentimes at making the transition to a world where they're really held accountable at a much higher level. And we think it's our moral responsibility, really, to come in and provide schools with the supports to ensure they're able to meet those expectations.
This is fascinating to me. In the past, a new school would be incubated and started, and then you would sort of launch it on its way,
right.
And then give it a call every 6 months and find out how it was going.
Yeah.
So this is like a new kind of idea,
yeah.
Is to follow up,
yeah.
And say, now that you're having growing pains, what do you need?
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And to my point earlier, to scale the successes that we're seeing at the school level, it's going to mean that we need to replicate what's working. And we've learned the hard way that it's not just enough to have one great school and then assume that school two is going to be great.
Hmm.
There are systems and there's codifying and there are human capital plans that need to be in place well before a school grows from school one to school two. And we've learned a lot about what that scaling up process should look like.
Who in the end decides whether or not you've succeeded?
So we hold ourselves accountable to really rigorous goals. We are unapologetic that the goal of our high quality schools plan is to ensure that more than double the number of kids in our city have access to a high quality school than what was true when we started our plan. And that's specifically for kids who live with an IPS, because we think that's where the most progress needs to be made. So we actually make yearly metrics, and we hold ourselves accountable to the number of kids in IPS that are attending A and B schools. And we share those with our funders, we share those with our key supporters, and we want to be held accountable for the outcomes that schools that we support are achieving.
Mm-hmm. Does the, I guess when we're talking about charter schools, we'd be talking about the authorizers, and I guess when we're talking about the innovation schools, we'd be talking about the IPS board.
That's right.
I mean, do they in the end decide whether or not what you're doing is effective?
Great question. So we're, you know, in a lot of ways, we're just a nonprofit. Now, you know, it's obvious that we are able to raise a lot of resources and that we do have a level of influence in our community. You know, but at the end of the day, we need partners who actually have decision-making authority around what happens in schools. And we are just incredibly blessed to have great partners in both IPS and the mayor's office who ultimately, at the end of the day, have the authority to make decisions for their schools. So we really see ourselves as a close partner to the folks that are making decisions. And we're able to do things like recruit outstanding leaders and support them for 1 or 2 years before their school launches. That would be hard for those organizations to do on their own.
I would assume that you would run into some people in the community who would be really suspicious that, you know, here's a not-for-profit that's funded or founded maybe 13 years ago that seems to have an inordinate amount of influence on how dozens of schools are operating now.
Yeah, so while I think we have broad support in the community, it would be a lie if I told you that we didn't have critics. And we for sure have critics. And I think, you know, I've been here 8 months, and one of the hallmarks of our organization over time is going to be, we're going to be with everybody, and we're going to have conversations with everybody, whether or not you support us or you don't support us. And we're going to listen to the feedback in our community. And when we need to make changes, we're going to make changes. So I would say that we are very cognizant of the fact that we have an immense responsibility to make sure that we're investing these resources in ways that are community-driven and in ways that are ultimately going to make our city better. And we're also cognizant of the fact that we need to be open to change, and we need to be able to hear the critiques and make changes when they're warranted.
Another criticism that I feel like I've heard fairly regularly is that the Mind Trust is basically corporate and political interests that are not interested so much in making sure, like, the most vulnerable kids get a good education, but that, you know, that we make room for, you know, the fairly well-off kids who just need something different. Yeah. What do you guys say to that?
Yeah, so the first thing that I would say is we are a team of educators. I was a teacher. Most folks on my leadership team were teachers. We have several former school leaders in our organization. And, you know, at the essence of the people that work at the Mind Trust, we are a team of educators that wake up every day thinking about how do we help transform the lives of kids, especially kids that need the most support. And the great thing is we also have the facts on our side. So when you look at who attends charter schools, who attends innovation schools, so charters and innovation schools serve a greater share of low-income students and a greater share of students of color than even schools within IPS. So the facts are that the most vulnerable students who need the most supports are attending schools that we're incubating. And if you look at the research and if you look at the results, those students are performing objectively better than how they would have performed if these new opportunities were not there. So we definitely hear those criticisms, and we need to listen to the ones that are valid. But I'm actually really proud to say that the facts are on our side, and the work that we're doing is literally transforming the lives of the kids that need it the most. Right.
Wow, I feel 100% smarter. We're going to have to cut it off there, but thank you so much, Brandon. That was really enlightening.
Really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
My thanks again to Brandon. Hey, before you get on with your week, I wanted to draw your attention to a few stories in this week's print edition of IBJ. Reporter Mickey Shuey explains the sweeping changes proposed for Indiana's meagerly funded State Tourism Bureau in hopes of boosting the dollars available for marketing and attracting new visitors. Editor Greg Andrews explains how James Burkhart, the former CEO of nursing home giant American Senior Communities, is trying to get his felony conviction for fraud thrown out while he serves a nearly 10-year prison sentence. And Lindsay Erdody has IBJ's annual accounting of the biggest philanthropic gifts across the state, and the big winner for 2018? Sleepy Wabash College. You can read all of these stories in IBJ's print edition, which you undoubtedly have delivered to your home every week, or at IBJ.com. And remember, for complete unfettered access to all of our award-winning content, just click the subscribe button. As always, thanks for checking out the podcast. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.